Oh, let me see. Come on. 672B.
I agree. I was going to have a comment on 672 quickly. You know what I mean? Kelly?
Do we have a roundup in process?
And then I was going to go back to 523.
Are we doing a public hearing?
672. Well, I was going to start, Senator, on that. And then by that time, maybe the rest will get here.
You just changed the plan.
Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. What's the plan? Kelly, what's the plan?
I had told you maybe where we're going to go. Start on 523, but we might as well do the other one since. I don't think it matters.
Senator Shoemaker, would you come forward, please? I hear 672 is a very limited bill.
Yes, clearly.
Why don't we start just talking about that? Once the committee gets here with some more people, I want to jump to 523 because that's my primary move. I don't know where we're going to. For members of the audience, I don't know when I'm going to get back to 672. I want the senator's opening remarks on it. A number of you have signed up on that bill, but I primarily today want to deal with this 523 issue in terms of remarks that are going to be made by the senator to the committee as well as Representative Clark to the committee. So why don't you start right now? I want to open the public hearing on 672, Senator, and tell us your position on that bill. And then I'll see where the committee is in terms of membership being available as to whether or not I ask you to continue right into 523 or move to some other witnesses in 672, okay?
Fine. For the record, I'm Robert Shoemaker. I'm State Senator, District 3. Senate Bill 672 is a bill which amends the present living will statute in only one substantive respect, but it's an important change. It's a one-word change. The law presently provides that a living will, or more properly, a directive to physicians, shall be in the following form, and then the statute sets forth the form. This has raised a question in the minds of many people whether it is permissible to use a different form or whether the statute in effect says that only this form would be enforced. To answer that question, and also because I think the better policy is that a person should be able to prepare his own form of directive and have it express his or her wishes after thinking it through rather than accepting a statutory definition, the amendment changes the word shall to may, so that it says that the directive to physicians may be in the following form. The only other amendment in the bill is to change the word prolonged to postpone for grammatical purposes. It's a non-substantive amendment.
Mr. Chair. Senator, can you remind us about what the living will statute does? Just kind of bring some of us back up to speed on it.
Thank you, Representative Clark. The living will statute is a statute that's been on the books since, I believe, 1977, which permits a person, when competent, to sign a document, a directive to physicians, which instructs his health care providers that when he is terminally ill and death is imminent, to withdraw or withhold life-sustaining procedures so that that patient may die in dignity. It's a statute that's in effect, I believe, I'm going to say 33 states, at some number like that. It's also a statute, a form that is not widely used, despite its ready availability. It's not been picked up on and used by a lot of people, although it certainly is used by some.
What's the effect of that?
The effect of the
of someone not using it. Does that mean you can't execute a living will at all? Or what does that mean?
Well, if you don't, it's an optional, it's a right to execute a living will. Of course, you don't need to do it. If you don't, and you're become incapable and in terminal condition, there are then no instructions to the healthcare providers that they can look to for guidance.
Mr. Chair, if I could, Senator, I didn't communicate my question well. I'm sorry. What I meant was, if someone wants a living will, wants to execute a living will, but they don't want to use this form.
Oh.
Under existing law, they're just out of luck.
No, I don't think they are, in fact. I believe that you can execute a form of your own choosing because it would amount to your informed consent or withholding of informed consent. But it's never really been tested.
Okay.
And so I think
there's no statement in the existing law as to what happens if you don't use the prescribed statutory form, right? It's just,
correct.
Just an open question.
There's just, that's right.
Okay.
That's the end.
Mr. Chair, could I ask one more question? Senator, one assumes that the very careful language in the existing law is to make sure that certain things go through a person's mind, I assume, before executing a living will.
Mm-hmm.
If the goal of Senate Bill 672 is to make it possible for people to expand the directions that are in a living will, could you not do the same thing by saying that the directive may be in any form but shall include at least the following language? And if someone wants to add on to what existing statutory language is, they can do that. They can essentially add more language. But it seems to me to be helpful to have someone have to go through what's in the existing form before executing a living will, at least to run some of the questions through that person's mind. It may be presumptuous to assume that they wouldn't go through those questions anyway. But I guess what I'm saying is it the language that's in here that is the problem, or is it that can only be the language
that it can only be?
Okay, so if we were to perhaps say something like the directive may be in any form but shall include at least the following language. You see what I'm getting at there?
I think I see what you're getting at. I think I do have a difficulty, though, because all of the language is in forms of an instruction about what to do in certain circumstances. It isn't in the sense of the warning that's in 523, which sort of spells out the importance of what you're doing. It's just these are instructions. Those instructions, any of them, may be deemed inappropriate. For instance, a person might well want his directive to instruct his health care providers to do everything possible and to not withdraw life support. And it would be pretty hard to utilize any part of the present directive for that purpose. Perhaps it would be appropriate to provide that any directive would include a warning in much the fashion that the power of attorney bill does, to call attention to the person the importance of what he's doing.
That would get at exactly the same thing that my question raises. And you would not be opposed to that if we could work with you on the language for that?
Oh, I'd have no problem.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairman.
Mr.
Senator, I, for the life of me, can't figure out what the need for this bill is. I can't figure out for the life of me what this bill is all about. I mean, why you even need it. It says the directive shall be in the following form.
Right.
It doesn't say it shall be on the following form. I mean, it seems pretty clear to me. I'm trying to figure out what the problem is you're trying to address with this bill. It's not very clear.
Well, I'm sorry. Those who've worked with it, including attorneys who've worked with it, believe that what it says is that, at least the statute says, that a directive to physicians has to have these precise words in it, and only those words.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up, what's wrong with that?
Because it may not fit everybody's wishes.
Mr. Chairman, again, could you give us some examples of some situations where it would deviate from the language that's in the form?
Okay.
Where it's necessary to do that?
One example would be where a person wants to instruct his physicians to not withdraw life support at any point, to do everything possible, however remote, in order to keep life going. That would be one extreme example.
And Mr. Chairman, in response to that, wouldn't they do that if they didn't have this particular living will form signed?
No, not necessarily.
Whose obligation is it then to make that decision?
Well, that's a subject that we will discuss at some length when we're into 523.
I'm talking about 523, yeah, I'm but talking about right now.
The dilemma, that poses the dilemma about what do you do when the patient, who is the one who is to give health, who is to make health care decisions for him or herself, cannot make them. Who decides what to do?
I guess the question, I still have to ask the same question, what happens now?
If consensus can be reached among the family or whatever group is gathered about the bedside and the physician, that generally is what will occur. If consensus cannot be reached, what happens is nothing happens until consensus is reached, which means you may just continue on with some inappropriate treatment, or you may postpone instituting treatment until you've reached consensus. Also, what sometimes happens, I believe, is that the physician will just assume the position of command and will do what he or she thinks is best. But both those cases may well depart from what the principal wants.
Mr. Chairman, another question.
That's gentle, Representative Minutes.
For that, appreciate it. Can you give us some additional examples beyond the...
The first numbered paragraph of the directive says, where the application of life-sustaining procedures would serve only to artificially prolong the moment of my death, and where my physician determines that my death is imminent, whether or not life-sustaining procedures are utilized, I direct that such procedures be withheld or withdrawn. It could well be that for a particular patient, he doesn't want to have the imminence be the trigger, that if he is terminal and incapable but can linger on for a long time, he would not want life-sustaining procedures. This form would not permit that direction.
Mr. Chairman, again, another question. The bill was sponsored by the Multnomah County Medical Society. Could it be that rather the patient doesn't want the imminence of their death to be there, or is it that the physicians don't want to make the determination that death is imminent?
I've never heard that the physicians have difficulty making that kind of diagnosis. Physicians are patients' advocates, and I don't think that's the problem.
Mr. Chairman. Senator, in response to your first example that you gave, the continuation of life-sustaining treatment, wouldn't we be better served by just including on line 16 that these treatments can be either withheld, withdrawn, or continued?
Well,
circle the one you want.
That is a way to get at it. I personally think that we shouldn't in a statute be telling free people what their decisions can be regarding the end of their life. And if that's what that does. You give them a series of choices, but you don't include all the choices. So I respectfully
disagree. I've got another question, Senator, while you're at it here and you're hot. Can you give us an example of a situation where death is not imminent and the living will procedure would apply? And in that instance, what is it that they would be withdrawing?
One example is an example that I had to deal with as an attorney when I first got involved in this field. It was a patient who was permanently comatose due to a heart attack and a failure to be revived promptly enough so that he had permanent irreparable brain damage to the point that he was comatose. Also had a kidney ailment and was on dialysis. His kidney ailment was terminal, but on dialysis he could live for a long time. His mother, who was his guardian, petitioned the court for permission to take him off the dialysis machine because the doctor wouldn't do it. The court asked our firm, and the firm asked me to advise it what its legal responsibilities were under the law at that time, which was about 1980. And I did the research. And, of course, I checked with the physicians and several physicians regarding the medical diagnosis and prognosis and advised the court that under the law of privacy, the court could order that the dialysis be turned off. The court couldn't handle the question and kept coming up with other questions, refusing and declining to make the decision, and this went on for 18 months till finally the patient did die, despite the dialysis. I think that is an example of a patient who had a terminal condition. His death was not imminent, whether or not life-sustaining procedures were utilized, because if they were utilized, he'd live for 18 months. At great expense to his family and emotional suffering and to the state in financial obligations. And he had indicated orally when his sister, believe it or not, went through much the same trauma from a different set of illnesses that he hoped nothing like that would ever happen to him.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that, Mr. Chairman? Senator, are you aware of any situations that have existed medically, or can medicine prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a patient who is comatose or incapable of making a health care decision, who also has a condition described as being terminal, that they can say with some degree of surety that that person is going to die, or have there ever been cases where the physicians were wrong and someone's actually recovered from a condition that was diagnosed as such?
Well, I can't answer that with certainty. I doubt very much. I would be virtually certain you'd never find a case where if someone was comatose, as I've described, and had a terminal condition from a different condition, that they would both recover consciousness and recover from the terminal condition. I mean, I think that is beyond possibility. I also think that when a patient has been, I understand that when a patient has been comatose for a long enough period of time, several months, that they don't come back. However, I would remind the committee that that is not an issue that is before us today. There's nothing in this bill, and there's nothing in the other bill we will be discussing that freely permits the withdrawal of life support from a comatose, non-terminal patient.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't understand your last statement, because I thought that's what you were talking about in terms of the eminence and the example that you just gave.
This particular patient was comatose, but was also terminal. We're not dealing with the comatose situation. I use that as an example to illustrate a case where a directive executed according to the form would not have worked. And one can think of other situations where a patient's life, for all practical purposes, has ended, and yet life support can keep them going for a long time, but there's no question about the outcome, and there's no question that there's going to be any kind of a return to any sort of a state of consciousness or enjoyment or anything else, where you just linger on and on.
Senator, let's move to 523. Close effort on 672, and let's go to 523. We're going back to the floor, what, at 4 o'clock?
That's correct.
I want to get some action or get something. I want to know, now, you're going to take us through the bill, is that correct? Right, Representative Clark, is that what the situation is? And then you're going to,
well,
we hope to get that much done today, or?
Mr. Chair, I just thought it seemed to me to be a little bit unfair for us to be taking apart Senate Bill 523 when we had basically asked Senator Shoemaker whether he'd be willing to come back and walk us through it step by step, and we were taking the bill apart before we really understood it, as far as I'm concerned. And as the committee knows, I've got some substantial amendments to him, but before we started advocating those amendments, I really wanted to hear from Senator Shoemaker and find out what the bill's supposed to do.
Okay, Senator.
Okay. Effectively, 13 different areas of concern on the bill, and I was wondering if the senator might, in order to maintain some kind of focus as to what changes we might make, the senator might address those 13 areas of concern that the council has helped us with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Calhoun, I have provided Senator Shoemaker with a copy of my list. He will go through the bill. And as it is, my list is primarily in order of the sections, and so he will, as he's addressing the section-by-section list, address the issues that I have raised in this as well.
Hey, Senator.
Any members should all have copies.
Yeah, I will. I do have that list, and I will try to comment upon each of those points as we discuss the sections to which they relate. Let me first, in the broad concept, describe the purpose of the bill and why I think we need it. Its underlying purpose is to retain the right to autonomy in making health care decisions. Before we had the technology that we now do, it wasn't a great big problem. But now we all know that a person can become incapacitated, and there are a great array of healthcare decisions yet to be made. And as things stand today, and as we discussed a few minutes ago in discussing Bill 672, there isn't any process set up to deal with that. And so the family and the physicians muddle through, and decisions are made, of course, but they're not always the decisions that the patient would make. You have people that may have different perspectives on his or her life than he has, who by default are making those decisions. The purpose of this bill is to allow a person to appoint someone he trusts to make health care decisions for that person when that person can no longer make them or cannot make them, even though he may return to a capacitated state later at a time he cannot make them. We, under this bill, encourage the principal to indicate in the power of attorney his whatever directions he wishes to provide, either in the document or orally or however a person would go about that. But then beyond that, when you don't have specific marching orders, that the judgment of the selected agent would be substituted for the decisions of the principal, which is as close to autonomy as you can get, rather than having some third party, whether related or unrelated, making decisions for you. It's very important to the senior citizens in our society that they have this right, and that's why you have all heard from so many of them. They care a lot about this. You worry about these things when you know that your own death is not so very far down the road. Everybody currently has the right to accept or refuse any medical procedure. Why should this right be taken away from a person when he becomes incapacitated? Why should you trust a doctor who you may not have met to make those decisions through default? Or why should you allow some disaffected member of your family to intercede into the decision-making process because of a sense of guilt that that person might carry around with him, or for whatever other reason, and prevent decisions which you would want to make from being made? It differs from the living will in that the living will is an inflexible document. Even if we permit any form, it's still something you have to think through in advance of need, and you don't know exactly what the situation is going to be when you get there. This way, you trust someone else to make those decisions, giving them whatever guidelines you think are appropriate. Another very important difference, and this is something that I know addresses a concern that several people on the committee have, about should this apply only to decisions regarding made in case of terminal conditions. It's true that that has been the focus of the discussion on this bill because that's the most sensitive area in which those decisions are made. But I would tell you that most of the decisions that the attorney, in fact, will be making are not whether or not to pull the plug. The decisions are going to be about medical treatment. What treatment to accept or reject or to choose between? What specialist to bring into the case? Those kinds of decisions, which are part of the process of health care. The attorney, in fact, would be making those decisions in consultation with the physician, just as is done by the patient today and when the patient is capable. So that's the guts of the bill. Now to the particular provisions.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah,
Senator, can I stop you and ask you a couple of questions there? One of your statements was that when a person becomes incapacitated, why should we take that decision? I think your phrase was, why should that decision be taken away from him or her at that point? And it seems to me that the decision is going to be taken away from him or her by definition. The question is, who do you give it to? And this is where I go around circles and say, I mean, as I see the choice, 523 says we're going to use the substituted judgment of somebody who has been appointed by the principal as the closest we could get to what the principal would want.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the other philosophical choice would be to say, and I didn't really, something like the following, and I didn't really realize it until the other day when I was talking to some people from the medical community about this, and I said, what happens now? And their comment was, well, sort of like your comment, people kind of muddle through. The family gets together, and they scratch their heads, and they get the hospital ethics board together, and sometimes they pull in a judge, and they kind of muddle through and eventually maybe reach a decision. And one of my thoughts was, gee, you know, those are pretty good places for those decisions to be made. I mean, in terms of if you were going to look at all the possible places in our society where you would want those decisions to be made, medical ethics boards, judges, and families are three pretty good places where you might end up. And so it seems to me that, 523 presents us with this choice. Where do you want those decisions to be made? Because the decision is going to be pulled away from the principal by definition, because they're incapable. And I gather you would advocate strongly that the principal, the principal's desires and choices there ought to be preeminent. And I appreciate that argument, and I understand that argument. But it seems to me that that's a choice. It's not a question of carrying out the desires of the principal, affecting, allowing the principal to make the decisions or not, because the principal can't make the decision at that point. It's a question of who do you give the decisions to.
I think that's fine. I think that's you've described the dilemma precisely. And some people may choose to let those decisions be made through the combination of physicians and ethics committees and courts and families. Others would prefer to lodge that authority in someone they trust. And do remember that it's an optional form. Nobody has to use it.
Point well taken.
Okay. To the bill, I'll try to not touch on every single subsection. I think that would be burdensome. I'll try to pick on some of the questions that I know have come up. Health care decisions, one question is asked on this memorandum of the 13 points. Do health care decisions include decisions regarding nutrition and hydration? And does it